When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul, what's happening?
Not much. I was going to make a rerun.
Happy holidays.
I was going to make a rerun joke, but I don't know how many people would get that what's happening rerun. I'm old, and I liked really terrible TV shows from the 70s, apparently.
Oh, was that terrible, though?
Yeah, I think it was. I loved it.
It might have been.
I loved it, but it was not good.
I loved it, yeah. But then again, Welcome Back, Kotter, I thought was one of the greatest, you know, pieces of television.
It's comedic gold.
Right, as when I was, you know, 8.
So today on the program, we'll be discussing Fables. That wonderful... How do you describe Fables? I guess we'll talk about it.
I guess we will attempt to do... I think that's our job.
Exactly. Anyway, we're going to talk about Fables.
We have one job.
It's that classic... one of those classic comic books in the great pantheon of things. And we'll tell you if it's good or not, because we are the arbiters of quality.
Well, absolutely. It is known.
But first, on a sad note, so at the time of this recording... it's been a couple weeks now. Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman in pretty much everything from the early 90s till today.
As the voice actor.
The voice actor. Well, some would say the best Batman ever.
Many have said that.
Yes. I might be in that camp. Adam West is up there too, but Kevin Conroy definitely just good. Anyway, he passed away a couple weeks ago now. And
I was always partial to Bruce Wayne as the best Batman actor.
Ooh, very good. I learned something this morning that was disturbing and shook me to my very fiber of my being. You've never seen the animated series of Batman.
I have not.
Good Lord, man. That honestly, it shocked me because it's just one of those classic things. And we even did a Paul Dini comic on this particular program. Yeah, so anyway, I saw that show. We talked about this a little bit off mic. Where I was just out of college, right when the animated series started airing, and I worked at night as a cook in a restaurant. So I worked nights, which means I had all day to do nothing and except watch cartoons.
Or read comics.
No, I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and she was very concerned that I read comic books and watched cartoons all day, which it's a very strange thing. It's like, totally acceptable
probably
today.
You are not alone. Paul, you are not alone.
Yes. But no, I stumbled upon that cartoon. It was on the Fox animated, you know, block of superhero shows, and it was really good. I was actually shocked at how good it was at the time. But Kevin Conroy voiced Batman, and he just was perfect. There's no other way to describe it. He was perfect as Batman. And Bruce Wayne, there's a subtlety in his performance. Where
I read up, he used two different voices.
Yes, and it's very, very subtle. You might not even notice it as you're watching the program. But there's one episode, and I can't remember what it's called, but there's Batman is on the phone with Commissioner Gordon, and they have to patch in Bruce Wayne. So it's Batman talking to Bruce Wayne over the phone. And he's just going back and forth, modulating his voice. And you could hear the subtleties in it. You know, I watched it in awe, saying, my God, the guy's amazing. Because it is. It's just a slight modification of his voice, a little bit higher, a little bit, you know, not as confident. Whereas the Batman voice is very deep.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, he was amazing. There's another series. He went on to voice Batman throughout all the animated stuff through the 90s and early 2000s.
Right. And I read where Mark Hamill basically said he wouldn't even bother reading a script for one of the animated, because Mark Hamill was the Joker, right?
And so, yes. Yeah.
But I read a quote where Mark Hamill said that he wouldn't even worry about reading the script. If Kevin Conroy was doing it,
yes.
Mark Hamill
yes.
was in.
Exactly. And there's lots of, yeah, Mark Hamill was posting all kinds of stuff right after he died and telling really great stories. I saw one story about apparently these two kids were at a convention, and Kevin Conroy was there, and they went up to him and said, "Hey, sir, are you Batman?" And he said, "No." He started to walk away. Then he turned around and said, "I am vengeance." And the kids just clapped. And I don't know. I just he embodied and he embraced the whole role. And apparently, he was a, you know, he was a theater actor, classically trained, and didn't really know, he knew who Batman was, but he wasn't really, you know, wasn't fully, he didn't know all the lore and whatnot.
Right.
But he took it on. I mean, he tells a story about being a gay man and having to live two lives. And he kind of took that and brought that into his performance.
Right.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised. I kind of know him from other things. When I was reading his bio, this was a couple weeks ago when it first happened, and I saw people talking about it, and I was like, I know that name, I'm familiar with the series, but what was interesting is seeing all of the tributes to him, and I was like, okay, well, let's look him up and see, and, you know, of course, I realized that he's the one that wrote the Finding Batman strip in the DC's Pride issue, and that is one of the best and most touching pieces of comics work I've read this year.
Yes, it's brilliant. And, you know,
his piece in a comic that respectfully, you know, trying to work on a lot of inclusion, which is a very good thing. And it's, you know, but, you know, you get like some cheesy stuff, like any kind of anthology comic, you get some cheesy stuff. But then Kevin Conroy's piece, the Finding Batman, is just so starkly better than everything else in that.
Yeah.
And better than a lot of like short pieces of comics that I've read throughout the year. And it really was emotionally stunning and touching in many ways. So
yeah, he's great. Now, I've never played any of the games, the Arkham games, which he voices, the video games, but apparently he's just amazing in that, where if you ever played a video game, there's a lot of celebrity voice actors who just kind of come in and they voice the lines and then they go home.
They're getting paid.
By all accounts, the Kevin Conroy voiced Batman in those games, he just gave it his all every single line. And you got to do a lot of lines,
right?
You know, for every you know, for every iteration of the game. By all accounts, the guy, he was just a very nice man and a brilliant actor. He got to play Batman live action in the CW Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. So he did actually get the live action Batman once. Mm-hmm. That was very fun, by the way, in that scene when he comes walking down the stairs and like, hey, it's him. But anyway, yeah. So I just, you know, it's a big loss.
Yeah.
I have very fond memories of Mr. Conroy.
In a year that we've lost a massive amount of comic book talent, this has been rough, but kind of inevitable. Because we're reaching that point where a lot of the artists that we're losing, like artists and writers and comic book folk, came of age or media, and I don't just mean social media, but I mean in an age where it's like the rock, it's like rock and roll. It's why losing all these rock and roll artists in the same way, it's like these are artists, musical, comics, what have you, who came up when suddenly like television existed and then eventually social media and magazines were covering. It's where these are all people who got covered and discussed in ways that previous generations had not. And right. So we're starting to see artists, writers, whoever, who became more part of the public consciousness. And I'm talking even going back to the 50s and 60s, but certainly moving into the 70s, 80s, and currently, that have been present in a way that other artists had not been. Does that make sense?
It does, of course. Yes. Yeah. No. And
we're starting to lose like identifiable artists. And like Kevin Conroy was part of many people's childhood,
adulthood in some cases,
or post college life.
Yeah. Post college life. I wouldn't call myself an adult at that point.
So I think some of this, it stings more when we feel like we have a closer connection.
Well, they become, you know, ingrained in our daily existence.
Right.
You know, we see their names, we see their work, we talk about them, and we feel their loss when it goes. Right. And definitely Kevin Conroy was something special. I'll miss him.
Yeah.
Never knew the man, but I know his work. And
right. Well, missing, yeah. Sometimes we see people like, you know, oh, people are being sad about celebrities and they don't even know who they are. It's like, it doesn't matter. When people impact your lives, right. You don't have to know them for their work to affect you and for one to be sad when that person no longer exists in the world. We have the work that they created that we can always go back to.
But which I have been, actually, the last couple of weeks. I've been kind of binging some old animated, my favorite animated Batman episodes. If nothing else, watch the Mr. Freeze episode, the origin of Mr. Freeze. Truly stunning. Good story.
I will check that out.
I wish I had the name of it. I should have wrote this stuff down. But everyone who knows the Batman, you know, the animated
Batman series, with Mr. Freeze, there's probably only one. I mean,
well, there's several, but the original one where you have his origin story, and everybody knows, anyone who's a fan of the animated series knows that particular episode.
Okay.
Because it's that good. All right. Well, farewell. Rest in peace, Mr. Conroy. On that note, let's take a break. And when we come back, we will talk about fables.
Woo!
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you, too, can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back. Brian, this week is your recommendation, so please tell us all about it.
I shall. Napoleon Bonaparte was born on August 15, 1769, and died on May 5, 1821. Between these two auspicious events, Napoleon built a reputation as a military leader of some note, had cold hands, and spent good portions of his later life vacationing on islands. He is often, probably erroneously, attributed with the quote, "What is history but a fable agreed upon?" In George Orwell's political fable, Animal Farm, Napoleon is a boorish pig who wrests control of the farm through nefarious means, eventually becoming the very thing he claimed to fight against. He was conflicted by how many legs an animal should have. It's complicated. In the comic book series Fables, there is no Napoleon, but there are three little pigs named Dunn, Posey, and Colin. Colin was a very good boy. Fables was launched in 2002 and ran for 150 issues, making it one of the longest-lived Vertigo titles. Created by Bill Willingham, the comic used public domain characters from throughout history and cultures, with the works of Hans Christian Andersen and the Brothers Grimm close at hand. But what Willingham did was transplant these characters outside their original context, placing them firmly in modern times, grouped together in clever ways, and living primarily in New York City or on the farm. More on that later. Originally penciled by Len Medina, Mark Buckingham came in for issue 6 and cemented himself as one of the iconic illustrators in any run of comics, penciling more than 110 issues. One of the greatest contributions Buckingham added was the use of minor or unknown characters interacting, often humorously, in the background, with no real context to the main story, but instead adding to the richer and larger tapestry of the world. James Jean, or James Jean, provided the stunning covers for the first half of the series, crafting an instantly recognizable dressing. The essential origin of the series revolves around a mysterious character named the Adversary, who decimated the multitude of fable lands. The survivors fled to a Mundi world, or our world, where the Adversary seemed to have no interest. Thus, many fables found themselves thrust together and forced to create a government of sorts in exile. A general amnesty is declared for all nefarious acts performed in previous lands, and all fables start with fresh slates. Complications arise naturally. While some fables live abroad, most are concentrated in New York and are spell-protected from detection from the Mundis. Others who cannot pass for human are relegated to a place called the Farm. Things happen. The first two story arcs, which serve for our purposes here, are essentially window dressing and a chance to introduce a myriad of characters. The first five issues are a murder mystery set in New York. The second five are a political thriller screed set at the Farm. Willingham has what we would call a point of view, and these are subtly present in these 10 issues. But he also is a master storyteller who juggles a vast wealth of literary and allegorical references into an actual, often engaging narrative. Not every story works, but more do than not. Some of Fables have not aged well, but some of them remain a shining example of the power of the comics medium in its ability to represent the fantastic and keep the idea of wonder alive. So, Paul, obviously, this was my recommendation. You were reading it. We both have read this numerous times before. What were your thoughts investigating this series under the umbrella of the collected edition?
Well, it's just, I mentioned it before we went to break, that this is one of the classic comics in the pantheon of classic comics.
Right.
I would put this up there with some of the best, you know, your Watchmen's and your Sandman's. There are some things that I find questionable, some references and attitudes, but you know, that's par for the course as far as reading an older comic. Overall though, wildly creative, incredibly, I mean, what a concept for a story.
Right.
It's been copied many times since this. Most famously, I think, for that ABC show, there was a show about fables living, or
Once Upon a Time. Or...
That's the one. Yeah. Oh, and then there was Grimm too.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's been copied many times, but this is the OG, as it were. And it's good. There's some good stories in it. I'll get into, you know, we'll quibble about some things as we get into the discussion. But overall, this is a fine story.
It's as a concept, again, it's quite stunning. And it's weird to me. So these first two story arcs, it's interesting to me. So Fables landed with a bang and people were just falling over themselves. I remember when it came out and like all of the comic press at the time were like, this is phenomenal. This is amazing. And what is interesting to me going back and reading these two story arcs, which I enjoy both of them, but as I referenced in my intro, they're both setups.
Yeah, it does. It suffers a little bit from first issue syndrome because it spends a lot of time setting up the world, setting up the characters, meeting the characters. Not enough time to get to know them, but it's essential. It's essential to get us immersed in this very complicated setup.
Sure. I mean, and I don't think we're supposed to. And I think what Willingham does very well is, I mean, I have a list here of all of the characters he introduces.
Oh, there's a lot.
As I'm reading through, I just stop like every time a new character, I write down the new character. And some of them are barely there. Cinderella.
Flycatcher.
One of them, Flycatcher, without his hat yet. Pinocchio has one scene. Pinocchio, who becomes a very important character down the line, but just has one scene where he's just complaining about how his balls haven't dropped.
Yeah, very upset with the Blue Fairy for being literal. Right. I want to be a real boy forever. No, no. There's a lot of, I mean, and each of the characters have very specific backstories that will play into the series as it goes along. And there's a lot of that little hints and, you know, dropping little bits of information throughout the story.
Beauty and the Beast, or Beauty and Beast get, you know, some, I'll call it screen time, panel time. And of course they're very important, but, and Boy Blue, gets a good amount of time, but we don't really see
who he is. He's definitely a supporting character in this point.
And Flycatcher, like you said, is very much a supporting character. Bufkin only gets named later on. You know, I mean, but I think what he's doing is on purpose.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's
he has a plan for all of these characters. And what is great about the first arc in particular, I think it's good that he did a murder mystery as the first 5-issue arc, because it establishes Big B.
No, I agree with you. I think the structure of this is perfect. The first 5 issues are about the New York setup. So we get to know what the premise of the story is. And then the second 5 issues are about the farm setup. And we get to know what's going on up there. Like I said, it's essential that he did it this way, because there's so many characters and there's so much lore he has to throw in there. And it gets us in there. And then the idea of doing it as a murder mystery, you're right, it does establish Big B as the, you know, as who he is and the rough and gruff noir detective. But it also allows Willingham to interrogate the characters. So they have to tell you about, it's a plausible way for them to tell you their backstory.
Right. And we get, like, again, like a lot of very interesting backstory, even in, like, with Cinderella, just a panel or two, you know, or Pinocchio. It just is, it's really, really, the murder mystery itself is kind of okay.
I have a note here. It says, murder mystery is a bit of a dud.
It's a bit of a dud. You can kind of see it coming from a mile away.
And the conclusion is a little, it resolves with an underwhelming
resolution. It's Scooby-Doo. They literally unmask.
Yes, it's true.
Spoiler alert, so Rose Red is murdered, or potentially murdered, but of course, you know who killed Rose Red? Rose Red killed Rose Red.
Yes.
And he literally pulls the hair in the end, in the parlor scene, Big B literally just pulls the hair off of Rose Red.
And she would have gotten away with it too, if it weren't for these damned kids.
Right. And so it's a fun story, and structurally as a story arc, it works and it's okay, but then again, is it really the point? The biggest point is to let Big B and Snow White work through their sexual tension.
Which are words you put together in a sentence. The Big Bad Wolf and Snow White had to resolve their sexual tension.
But it's hilarious. I mean, the dialogue is, like, there are times I laughed out loud. There's a scene where Beauty and Beast are talking, and I think Beauty is getting mad at Snow White, because Snow White is the she's the real person who works the government. King Cole is the titular head of the government.
He's
the gladhander, and it's Snow White who's doing all of the real administration. So, like, one of the best parts is when Beauty, you know, is getting mad at Snow White because Snow White's not addressing the issue that she's having. And, you know, she references that dirty little business she got up to with the with the seven dwarfs.
Someone
refers to Big B as a son of a bitch. And he's like, well, yeah, but she was a great mom.
Yeah. There's some really good dialogue, but there's also some dialogue that's questionable. I don't know if you agree with me or not, but there's a heck of a lot of misogyny going on.
Oh yeah. So also I should talk about the art, and this keeps with this, and it keeps with, because this is a Vertigo title, it should be noted Willingham used to write porn.
I forget what the name of the comic he used to do, but he did a very explicit comic.
And I think what is interesting here, and this is keeping to your point, William Hamm is writing a Vertigo comic, and one of my notes is there's a lot of F-bombs and a lot of sexy time, particularly women presented in a gratuitous manner. And that also keeps with what you were saying with dialogue and the misogyny in some of the dialogue. So if you wanted to expand further on your
concerns. It's an interesting dichotomy that Willingham is working with here, because he essentially has the two lead characters are Snow White and Rose Red. So he has female protagonists to the story. I mean, Bigby would be the third in that group. But Snow White is essentially the lead of this story.
Right.
At the same time, he goes out of his way to have people make derogatory jokes and just belittle her sexually. And it's all with, you know, tongue in cheek and, you know, I'm just flirting with you. Like, there's a scene in the farm where Snow White and Rose Red are getting ready for bed, and it just has them get undressed to sleep in the same bed together. They're sisters. It's like, you don't need that, but I guess they were edgy.
There's some uncomfortable dialogue that they're having.
Right. About, you know, seducing each other. And
yeah. And it's not necessary.
Yeah. It's not needed for the story it's not needed
because Rose Red and Snow White are very conflicted with each other. In general, not sexy time, but conflicted, like their sisterly relationship has been strained for hundreds of years.
Yeah, they have emotional baggage with each other and jealousy. And again, not sexual in any way. And yet Willingham sexualizes it. I don't know. It's.
And we have there's also a weirdo thing that he does later with Goldilocks. That's again. Yeah. Unnecessary.
Yeah,
we could get to that. We haven't hit the farm yet, but
that's what Goldilocks said. We could go in. It's just an interesting. I don't remember it being this way, but it's been many years since I read these issues.
I think it gets better because I did not go and read all 150 issues for this.
No,
there's part of me that now wants to. During all of my massive free time. But I feel like, so his female protagonists are often stronger in my memory than most of the male protagonists. I mean, you know, he writes Cinderella really well. And again, these are things that I'm remembering.
Yeah, but Cinderella becomes this badass special agent, essentially, like a James Bond type. I remember that being very empowering, you know.
But memory's funny, right? It's remember, and we run into this all the time when we're doing these, or when we reread comics that we perhaps loved at a particular time in our lives, that as we've grown, I would like to think that we go back and things are a little skeevy. So your comment about some of the misogyny going on here, I think is accurate.
Yeah. And just, you know, Reynard the Fox makes some comments to Snow White where I'm just like, really?
Reynard, who is a great character.
Yeah, he is. And that's the thing. Everything about this, the setup, the situation, it's incredibly creative, and it's the characters are rich and full, but then he throws these little sexual innuendo jokes in there. It's like, that doesn't fit. That's the one big quibble I have with this series. Yeah.
And I feel like as he progresses, as the series progresses, when he realizes he doesn't, just because he's on Vertigo doesn't mean he has to. I have a note about language, because I feel like it's really throwing out like every cuss word. And I think other writers, when Vertigo opened things up, did that too. I'm looking at you, Garth Ennis.
Well, we talked about this during when we did the Spectre, which was, you know, at that time, there was like this liberation of, you know, oh, the comics code is gone. We can do anything we want. And what that translated to was sex and gratuitous violence. The writers who did it really well, like Gaiman and Alan Moore and Morrison, were able to incorporate mature themes without being gratuitous. And even Gaiman went there a few times. Yeah. So and more.
Gaiman had some issues in the early Sandman. I don't mean to, neither you or I are Puritans. We've been known to, you know, I certainly can talk a blue streak.
I've had sailors say, you know, take it down a notch, dude.
there are parts of it where it feels like William fell victim to the we're on Vertigo now, so I can just throw certain things out because I get to. You know, I think it settles down, and I think he's able to, maybe not in these first 10 issues, but it does settle down a bit as things go on, even as the structure of the series goes on. And one of the things I miss is the borders that come into play eventually down the line that Mark Buckingham does, and the way the narrative tightens.
So, exactly. I think he gets more comfortable with his world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he kind of fully immerses himself and the reader into this world, and he doesn't have to shock us anymore. He allows the characters to be who they are. But this is set up, and I think it's a genuine criticism, but it doesn't negate how good this is.
Right. And again, I'll probably come back to this several times because I think it's one of the most noteworthy things. You know, we haven't even mentioned Jack of Fables, who is such a wonderful, rich character. And Willingham is clearly having a lot of fun with say, Jack of Fables, who is one of the primary. It's hard to say, like, in these two story arcs, these 10 issues, the major protagonists are Snow, Bigby, and Rose. And they remain, in many ways, prime characters. But a lot of these minor characters, Jack of Fables becomes a very, very, very important character.
Yeah, he gets his own series.
Right, he gets his own series, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So he's just being introduced here. I mean, we get the idea of who he is, but he doesn't get developed until way down the line.
Blue Boy becomes an extreme, and Blue Boy is Little Boy Blue, becomes an extremely important character down the line. Like, and Flycatcher becomes one of the most important characters down the line.
Right.
And this is just the first 5 issues that we get very brief. Prince Charming, we haven't talked about Prince Charming. But when you talk about the misogyny with Snow and whatever, we also have those scenes with Snow and Prince Charming where she owns his ass in every scene.
Yes, that's true. Well, he's not that bright.
No.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's another, see, that's the thing. He's making these female characters really strong, then sees the need to belittle them. And I don't want to keep harping on that, but it was very weird to me.
It is certainly a thing. I would also like to mention, at the end of the day, this first story arc, you know, it's a murder mystery, Rose Red and Jack of Fables fake her murder so that they could get out of a contract that they had with Bluebeard, because Rose Red was going to marry Bluebeard, but she wanted a prenup, so she got all this money. The money she wanted was to help Jack of Fables and all of his failed business ventures. Jack of Fables' business ventures fell apart. They concocted a scheme where Rose Red would be dead so they wouldn't have to pay Bluebeard back the money.
Yeah.
And hilarity ensues.
Yeah, it's essentially an insurance scam.
It's an insurance scam, and you know, Big B solves the murder. He gets his parlor scene, and we get to establish Big B as, like you had referenced earlier, the big noiry. He's Humphrey Bogart.
I think it's really interesting because you see him always smoking, and that's sort of like the trying to establish that, you know, smoky room detective kind of thing. But he's actually smoking for a reason, which we don't get in this.
We don't know yet why he smokes as much as he does, but we can guess as a wolf with a strong sense of smell.
Yeah, so he's trying to dull his trying to dull his senses so he doesn't have to smell everything all the time.
We're giving something away that becomes important down the line. But his smoking also has the witty, humorous bits with him and Snow White, who's always telling him not to smoke, and then he does anyway. And we're establishing, you know, him and Snow. But I think, you know, so the first 5 issues work very well as, like, it's all introduction.
Yeah, it establishes the world we're living in.
You know? Yeah. What I think is what is fascinating, this is one of my major themes, is just how well it's like, how do you take all of these disparate fables? And remember, he has to work with public domain. So there were a lot of people who are like, where's Peter Pan and all of this? Whereas, and a lot of these characters, everybody's is like, how come this character isn't, how come that character isn't in it? It's because a lot of these were still held with copyright.
Yeah, he mentions Narnia, but none of the characters from Narnia show up.
Right, and he can't say Narnia specifically. It's a very, I love that scene where there's one of the great things in this. There's a couple really interesting. So there's Remembrance Day, where they talk about the history of the adversary taking over the Fable Lands. And so they reference like the adversary taking over the Emerald Isle or the Emerald Lands, which means the Wizard of Oz. And what did he refer to? I can't remember now what he referred to the Narnia lands as, but he talks about that holier than thou lion.
Right.
That nobody liked because he was like, thought he was better than everybody else.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, but that's also like as part of the dressing is it refers to the whole, what's the saying, you know, they came for so-and-so and I was silent. They came for so-and-so and I was silent. Right. They came for so-and-so and I was silent. And then when they came for me, there was nobody to take for me. I'm mangling that. But that is the underlying thing here is the fables, when the adversary was starting to take over the various fable lands, nobody did anything because it wasn't affecting them personally. This is a thing that carries on throughout the entire series.
Yes. But this is not a political comic book.
Do we want to do the politics now, or do we want to until we hit the political second arc?
I'll set the stage. Just to, you know, in an interview, Willingham has said that it was that this whole thing was a metaphor for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Whether you want to go with that or not, don't know. But he also argued that it is not a political tract; it never will be. And he keeps using these words. I do not think they mean what he thinks they mean. There's nothing but politics in this. And he keeps saying that it's not political, but we'll get to it. We'll get to it when we get to the farm.
Yeah. I would also like to note in the, as we move on to the next arc, I would be remiss without mentioning that Colin the pig just wants to be a city pig. And every issue in this arc shows Colin enjoying greatly his time in the city and does not want to go back to the farm, and they keep telling him he has to go back to the farm.
But well, that's, I mean, sad. Yeah. Sad what happens to Colin, but you find out later that he's supposed to be there spying and gathering allies, but he's really just lying in the sun and getting drunk.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
But I think this is also structurally what's great about what Willingham does is every issue shows just a panel of Colin enjoying himself in the city in various ways. You know, you're like, that's just a very happy fellow.
Well, it's interesting because I what happens because we've read the story, but I do remember the first time reading through this. It's like, what's up with this pig? I don't get what's going on with this pig.
Why are there random panels of this pig just enjoying his life? Great writing by Willingham, because we find out.
Do we have anything more to say? I mean, the first five issues, like we've talked about, it's set up. The mystery is kind of meh, but we get to meet all the characters and lays the groundwork for the setting.
My God, there's so many more coming. Well,
the main protagonists, we get to see them. And antagonist in Bluebeard, or anti-hero, because it is the 90s. You have to have an anti-hero. Yeah, so we get to meet. So, yeah, the first five issues get us. We meet the main characters and we get set up in, this is what the New York fables. Yeah. sounds like a rich family. Oh, you're from the New York fables. Oh, I see. But then the second arc, we get to meet the other major setting.
Yeah. So the farm, and it is very interesting, you know, so, I mean, the farm is where the fables who can't pass for normal humans have to stay because while in New York there are sorcerers and witches who have spells to protect from Mundy intrusion, Mundy being us regular folk.
Yeah, there's magical. So the magical wizarding world is held from the as protected from the Muggles. I mean, the Mundies. Yes,
yeah, and
old J.K. did a lot of reading before she wrote.
I feel like J.K. read some, like at least a couple Vertigo titles that I can think of.
Yeah.
So the idea is like on the farm is where the let's call them non-passable. There are some rules about creatures who live or the animals, it's mostly animals who live on the farm have to adhere by that the regular folk in the city do not have to. So that said, we start the second arc with Snow and Rose trying to, or Snow deciding she's going to rekindle her relationship with Rose Red.
Yeah. And Rose Red, because of the crime that she committed, has to work on community service at the farm. So that's kind of her punishment.
So Rose and Snow proceed to leave the city to head to the farm, which is in, I believe, upstate New York. Also an area protected by magic so that planes flying over can't see certain things and what have you. Yeah, Rose and Snow head out and in their beat-up little pickup truck with Colin in the back. And they get to the, but before they get to the farm, they stop to fix the radiator or whatever, you know, cars and stuff. And Rose finds a bunch of bullet casings, or not Rose, Snow does.
Yeah.
And which befuddles her, but she's like, okay, whatever, let's just continue on. So they get to the farm and there's nobody around. They're like, well, that's strange. So they go into this barn and there are many of the fables living on the farm. Listening to speech by Napoleon, I mean, Dunn. Yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, but no, this is a scene.
I'm just gonna beat on that, yeah.
Well, this arc is called Animal Farm, and literally, this is a scene from Animal Farm.
Yeah.
Where Napoleon is giving a speech. Or I guess it's Snowball who gives the speech.
Yeah, it's Snowball is like the Minister of Information, if I remember correctly. From right. I'm sorry, the Minister of it doesn't matter.
Animal Farm, Orwell. Yes.
People who have read Animal Farm more recently than me can correct us on all this. But basically what is happening is that the animals on the farm are unhappy with their treatment.
They feel like they're in prison.
Right. And
essentially they are, yeah.
At the end of the day, they are. And so they're having revolutionary thoughts. And,
Vive la resistance.
Right. And so ostensibly what Dunn and Posey, who is the other pig, so we have three little pigs, although neither of them are little, Colin, Posey, and Dunn. Wow. Posey and Dunn are sort of leading this political revolution, generically being framed as we need to return to the homelands. And the homelands, of course, are the fable lands that were taken over by the adversary. And so they're advocating for, you know, taking over Fabletown in New York to get access to whatever it is that will allow them to return to the homelands. This is all explained. Some of these are references to things that happen later.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say they're modifying weapons so that, you know, animals can use them, that they don't have to be for human appearance. Kind
of brilliant, like a little hat you put on a turtle that has a gun on the top, so like a mouse can ride on top of the turtle and shoot.
Yeah. Well, it was the hare was supposed to ride on the back of the turtle.
Oh, the hare. Yes, of course, because yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, and then just guns that a pig can fire, that sort of thing.
Rose and Snow kind of walk into the middle of this. And Snow is oddly stupid.
Yes. Well, she has to be for the story to continue.
Yes. And the idea is that Snow goes twice a year to the farm to just, you know, be a representative and talk about their issues and whatever. So this is her trip. They weren't expecting her this early. And so there follows a scene of which there are many in this of pontification done by some of the animals, particularly Dunn and Posey, about equal rights, about them being in prison, so Waylon Smith is a character who was supposed to be administering the farm and he's not there. And Don is like, oh, well, he retired. He quit. He just left. And, you know, Snow at some point is like, well, yeah, but, you know, he was the best man for the job. And Don said, exactly, he was the best man. And so the whole five arcs is filled with a lot of proselytizing by Don, Posey, also Goldilocks, and various other characters. I have to be honest, I don't think Willingham meant necessarily for the same takeaway, and I may be wrong, but there is part of me reading this. Now, the ends justify the means is an interesting question always, but some of the arguments that Don and Posey and Goldilocks make, I don't feel are necessarily incorrect.
Well, that's the thing. Yes, the story is trying to frame it as they're crazy radicals and
they're malcontents.
They're malcontents, and they're, you know, they don't understand how good they got it. But they're talking about things. It's like, well, they're kind of right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you throw Andor in this mix, and you got yourself a revolution. Yeah. So maybe that was the point. Maybe I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say so. They're saying the right things. They're grievances are legitimate, but they're means to, and their violence is never a means to get what you need. Maybe right. That's what he's trying to say.
Yeah, it could be. And again, I don't want to do, you know, author intent criticism again, because we've already talked about what Willingham said the comic is maybe about. And there's part of me, even as a deconstructionist, I kind of want to read it more in a different way, criticism.
Yes. I'm not going to say this is what he meant when he did this. This is what I thought when I read it.
Essentially, Don creating, you know, he's an energetic speaker, I'm guessing, and is getting a lot of the Fables on the Farm to agree with his stance that they need to take back Fabletown, and then they need to go back to their home worlds. And
well, it is an interesting critique in that, because like we said, their grievances are legitimate. So it's not that far. That's not that hard to imagine someone being radicalized at that point.
It's really what an interesting concept that if you can play on somebody's grievances.
Yeah. Thank God that doesn't happen in the real world.
Right. Yeah.
This podcast is not political.
So the first issue or issue six ends poor Colin's head on a stake.
Yeah, Colin is...
Literary reference, kids.
Yeah, Colin is not completely on board with this particular course of action by the other pigs. So he is made an example of, which, literary reference.
It's and I have to be honest, like one of my notes, one of my primary notes is Colin is the real tragic figure of this entire 10 issues. And I think he is.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And there's a wonderful scene at the very end of issue 10 with Snow White that I think is touching, that involves Colin. But
had they just let him be a babe pig in the city, he would have lived a very happy life.
Yeah, but it's probably the most disturbing panel for me because. Yeah. Again, Colin is made to be very likable. The circumstances with which he was supposed to be a spy, and he just didn't want to do it. He loved being in the city. This is awesome. And for his crime of wanting to be independent and enjoying his life, he gets his head put on a stake. Yeah. And
beautifully rendered. The art is gruesome and effective. Poor old Colin. I kept thinking like, oh, it's a fable story. He'll come back. Bring him back to life again. No.
Yes and no, but that's a theme that I want to talk about at the end. I think with this story arc, I don't, and maybe you have a lot more to say about it, because I have other like thematic things that some of this represents. But essentially what happens is there's a revolution going on. Rose is smart enough to understand that Snow White's life is in danger. And so she fake joins the revolution with the understanding that Snow won't be killed. A lot of kerfuffles happen. We're introduced to Reynard the Fox, who is loyal to Fabletown and loyal to Snow White. He has a hilarious little bit of physical comedy with Shere Khan and Bagheera. Again, yeah. More fables. He saves Snow's life. Snow eventually gets captured. She's chained up in a cave with Wayland, the aforementioned Wayland Smith, who has been shackled and put under spells. So he has to, it's Wayland Smith who's making all of the weapons.
Right.
Against his will. There's an interesting bit about he can't free himself, but he can free Snow.
That's actually a very funny little scene where he's able to forge a key to unlock Snow. And then she says, well, how do I get you unlocked? And he can't say because he's under a spell. It takes a while before she realizes she can use the key that he created to unlock him. And he was like, oh, it's about time.
Reynard shows up and is like, why don't you just use the key?
You got that. Anyway, that was a funny little bit.
And throughout all this, we have the introduction of Goldilocks, who is the sort of radical end of the revolution, the violent...
Yeah, she's kind of postured as the 1970s rich kid, radical, the Weather Underground kind of thing.
Yes, and she's, having sex or sleeping with one of the three bears.
With Baby Bear. Yeah.
Right, because his bed was just right.
I get the joke, but...
Right.
Yeah.
So, essentially, things come to a head. So, Goldilocks is, out. She wants to kill everybody. There's a whole bunch of everybody searching for Snow White in the city or in the farm itself. Rose is cozying up to Dunn and Posey, who are still making a lot of political speeches. Back in Fabletown, they catch wind that something's going wrong. So they send a posse of Bluebeard, Boy Blue, Bufkin, and Prince Charming to save the day.
As it turns out, was not necessary. This is Snow being a badass.
Right. So eventually things come to a head and Snow White gets freed and she realizes there are what they call the Big Dreamers. And it's in this valley in the woods outside the forest, which has three giants and a dragon.
She has them woken up.
And then they just come thundering into town. Basically, the entire revolution is over at that point, except Goldilocks gets away and shoots her in the head.
Goldilocks plays sniper there for a second.
Right. That right there is a theme I want to revisit once we finish up the final sort of wrap up of the narrative of this story.
Snow gets shot in the head. She doesn't get killed. She ends up in a coma.
And it turns out that Rose Red has been on Snow White's side the whole time. We get Bigby filling in some of the information because Snow White's been in coma for 6 months, I think at some point or however long, but eventually makes a full recovery. We have the executions done and Posey get executed.
Yeah. So all the rebel leaders get executed, which I found to be kind of shocking.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they were going to do that.
Reynard gets Reynard the Fox gets kudos for helping out. The three giants are transformed back into the are transformed with their permission into the three little pigs because we always need three little pigs in fable. Yes. And the dragon gets changed into a raven who can breathe fire and is Rose Red's best friend now.
Rose then gets to be Snow's counterpart running the farm since Wayland can no longer be the leader.
Right. And they all lived happily ever after.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Which poses the question before we get into some of the more interesting themes here. If they can change the giants into pigs, why don't they just change the non-human fables into humans?
Well, because remember they need magical spells to do this. Yes. And magical spells are extremely expensive. And they actually address this where it's Rose or somebody says, we need the operating budget for both the entirety of the operating budget for both the farm and Fabletown in order to transform these just four individuals into something else. So it costs the entire operating budget just for four spells. We get Frau Tottenkinder very briefly, not named. We haven't really met the magic users and the spell casters in the Fables universe yet, but they're charging money. Right. It's like we have a reference earlier. Bluebeard ran an underground railroad to get fables out of the homelands.
Yeah. He was a war profiteer, basically.
But he was a war profiteer. Yeah. He made a shit ton of money.
Yeah. By charging people to get them out with their lives.
Yeah. So everything costs money. It's not just a matter of, hey, let's just do this.
But they could.
They could, but they won't because Willingham is a capitalist.
There you go. That's what I was trying to get to.
And there we are.
End scene.
Capitalist pig. Indeed. Oh, wait, but the pigs weren't capitalists. Wait a minute. Now I'm confused.
A couple of things are mentioned here at the end that I thought were pretty interesting. And I think this is what you were alluding to before, mm-hmm. that the life of the fables are determined by how many people believe in them or read them.
Memory. It's memory and need.
So Snow White was able to be shot in the head, but she didn't die because everybody knows who Snow White is. And her story is constantly being told. Therefore, she can't die.
And this leads to a conversation she has. Oh, and it's also like with the three pigs. The reason that it worked for the giants to be transformed into the three little pigs is because fables demand that there must only be three little pigs. Because it's such a strong existing meme in memory.
And it doesn't matter that the three little pigs are the different pigs or have different names. As long as there's three pigs, mm-hmm. all is well with the world. Really interesting idea. I mean, Harlan Ellison, several authors have, but the one I can think of is Harlan Ellison has a story about gods only exist as long as you have faith in them. And it's sort of the same thing where as long as we tell these stories, as long as we still pass them on, these characters still exist.
And I think so Snow White survived basically having her brains blown out because Rose Red references the fact that she had bits of her skull and brains all over her after Goldilocks shot her in the head. You know, it's what is interesting is like we get in this last bit, like where Rose Red actually talks about the real reason for the rift between the two sisters and why Rose Red reacted, because nobody remembers Rose Red.
Yeah.
Because Snow White left her behind when she married Prince Charming.
Right. She went off on her own. She went to her own story, leaving Rose Red behind in her. And
leaving Rose Red without a story for people to remember. And so Rose Red is like, if I got shot in the head, like you did, Snow White, I would be gone. Because there's not enough collective memory. It's collective memory. There's not enough collective memory for Rose Red, whereas there is enough collective memory for Snow White that Snow White will always recover.
And which is really interesting. But then conversely, there's so much disdain for the Mundys and the real people.
Gods always hate that which worship them, right?
Well, yeah, but you would think that they would try to be cultivating their memory, their stories.
But they don't need to.
How
because
so?
The fable doesn't have to prove to the Mundy. You know what I mean? The fable doesn't have to prove itself. The fable exists. And the interpretation of the fable by, let's call it, you know, the Mundy is what keeps the fable going. The fable is not active in the collected memory of those outside of the fable.
Okay. Interesting.
We're personifying fables in this comic. And so that does create like a schism between what I just said and what, you know, here Willingham maybe creates a situation where a story can be actively engaged, but a story doesn't engage, a person engages with the story.
A story can take on a life of its own.
Right. Well, a story can be engaging, but can a story engage? It's the idea of like is and but this is what's really interesting about this comic is we're personifying fables into living things. So the idea is can or should a fable engage outside of their set parameters within consciousness?
Well, then it's similarly we're talking about the act of writing. We're personifying the act of writing, the act of creativity and storytelling, because these are public domain characters. So Willingham himself is giving these characters new life by putting them, he's taking the context out of their original story and putting them into a new one.
Does Snow White have agency, or is agency granted to Snow White? Does Snow White have independent agency?
Or is she dependent upon those who tell her story? Huh. See, this is really fascinating stuff. And as this series continues, we get more of that. And as I recall, again, I'd have to go back and read it. I think the quibbles we had with the misogyny and questionable aspects of the story kind of get left behind in the more philosophical. But
they should be noted. It is fair to note.
Yes, yes. I mean, it starts that way. Mm-hmm. Everything has growing pains. But the more philosophical and creative literary side of things really starts to get accentuated, and the story becomes better for it.
And I think the Willingham introduces this idea 10 issues into a 150 issue run, to be able to introduce that, even if just peripherally, is pretty well done.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is an incredibly well done story. And again, growing pains, trying to get established, but it's clear that Willingham has a grasp on what he wants to do. This is good stuff, Brian.
Yeah. Well, and I want to insert one last non-philosophical thing, and if you want to move this somewhere else in the discussion, but I felt like I should have done this earlier. Mark Buckingham is a genius.
Absolutely great. He was awesome with Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
Kidding. No, Mark Buckingham, absolutely great. Some of the artwork in this is fantastic. You mentioned the characters in the background, sight gags.
Yeah, I mean, he's the Sergio Aragonés of of Vertigo, right?
There you go.
Yeah. I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but we all know it's the. But no, like all of his background stuff, and he uses like the spoon and the three mice and it just what a wonderful career he made just as the illustrator of, and he has a full career doing other.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, he's done a ton of stuff.
He's working with Neil Gaiman right now, so he's
he's doing all right.
But like Medina's art was fine in the first arc, but like once Buckingham comes into play, and he is able to do all those wonderful little background things that can be ignored because they don't have anything to do with the narrative. But if you pay attention, you're like, that's good stuff.
Well, no, it's world building. It's really, the art in the beginning was a little funky, left me a little cold. It was a funky cold Medina.
Yeah.
But sorry, I'll cut that. But no, Buckingham's art was just, it's rich, and it builds the world. There's more going on than just
other artists have jumped in and done arcs or done things like, and good for Medina, who helped create this world in the first five issues. But Mark Buckingham, just, I can't think of Fables without his fantastic work on that series. And he's doing it now. We should note there's a continuation of Fables going on right now. Okay. I think it was a 12 issue. I'm reading it. Because of course I am, but
yeah, I am not. I'll probably get to it when it's in trade.
I just really think that you can't talk about, like, I'm trying to end this on a non-philosophical bent, yeah. I guess, but you can't talk about Fables without talking about Mark Buckingham.
I have nothing more to add than that. It's just excellent work, really rich. Right. And
at the end of the day, I think Fables is a really good comic. I think it's an important comic. I think, especially with stuff that we know is coming in the comic, like I said, not everything works, but a lot of it does. And Vertigo series ran for 150 stinking issues. Only Swamp Thing and Hellblazer lasted longer. Right. And both of those started before they were Vertigo.
Exactly. And you're right. I mean, not every story works. Not every, I don't always agree with the politics. Even though it's a non-political story, I don't always agree with the politics, but that's okay. I don't have to agree with everything I read. That's kind of the point of reading and learning, to get other points of view.
But as someone who is fascinated by archetype and allegory in real life, and in my own non-comic reading, activities, it's this hits so many good buttons.
As I said in the beginning, I hold it up there with, you know, in the great pantheons of great comics that everyone should read. Thanks for recommending this, Brian.
Good times.
Good times.
We discussed what I wanted to talk about, so I suppose we should allow you a chance to talk about what you want to talk about. Would you like to share with us whatever comic that... Okay. Paul, would you like to tell us what comic book we're going to read next?
Yes, we're going to read something a little bit different. We're only going to read a single issue of a comic, Brian. It's because it is the end of the year. We're going to do our end of the year special, and we're going to read Superman's Christmas Adventure from 1940.
Woo!
It is written by Jerry Siegel and drawn by Jack Burnley. This is a Golden Age comic. It's only a single issue, as I said, 16 pages, but it is from the Golden Age, so there's enough text there to be a six-issue run today. 12 issues if you're Brian Michael Bendis. But no, it's
don't cut that.
I won't cut that. No, it's a fun little Golden Age comics, so you can imagine what it's going to be. And there's a lot going on in this, and I think we'll have a lively discussion.
Well, and it's our holiday Christmas, so I mean, you know, we try to do something fun for the final post of the year. So I think this will be.
Last year we failed. Because last year we did Black Monday Murders.
Oh dear! Oh,
yeah, that was bad. I think we did Starman and Black Monday Murders for the end of the year.
Well, Starman works, but my God, Black Monday Murders, yeesh!
I know. That I mean, was me.
A great comic, but certainly not in keeping with a festive or joyous.
Exactly. I failed last year, so I'm doing a 180. But we're doing a silly comic from the 1940s. So that's what we're doing. Superman's Christmas Adventure.
Super.
It is super. So until next time, everybody, thank you all for listening. And, you know, let us know what you think about Fables. And is it political or not? Until we meet again, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.